I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media, we will continue our community conversation about important public health issues. We'll talk about consent and sex education trends in Indiana. My guests are Tanya Egan with Life Smart Youth, Zoe Patterson with the Kinsey Institute, and reporter Lauren Bavis. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today as part of our partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about another important public health issue. This is an ongoing community conversation we have. Today we're going to be talking about consent and sex education trends in Indiana. My guests are Tanya Egan with Life Smart Youth, Zoe Patterson with the Kinsey Institute, and reporter Lauren Bavis. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
John. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. It's good to have you here. And I'll invite our listeners to join this important conversation. To do that, you just need to call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So how about if we start here by talking first about what we mean about consent and about informed consent. I think, Lauren, you've done some reporting on this, so I will start with you.
I have, sure. So when we talk about consent, it was interesting. I got to actually observe a Life Smart class in Mooresville last month, and the instructor there broke it down pretty easily. Consent is just giving permission. But when we're talking about sex, of course, informed, enthusiastic consent is what we keep hearing about, continually asking, you know, a partner if they're okay with any activities that are going on. But it was interesting. The class I was in was trying to break down consent to middle school students. So usually you hear about consent conversations happening in college. This is much, much younger students, but the information they took really well, it seemed.
And Tanya, obviously you were referenced there. Could you talk about the kinds of things that you talk about in one of those sessions?
Sure. So the program that Lauren observed was CARE, which is communicating with and respecting each other. And we focus at that level on a four-day program where one full day is on consent. And in addition to that, we really kind of teach consent throughout all of our programs because it really is just giving permission for something to occur. And you can start teaching consent as early as age one. So we encourage a lifelong lesson on consent. But that program focuses on healthy teen dating relationships, signs to look for teen dating violence. But we really try to help kids have the tools beyond texting on how to communicate, how to navigate their own choices, their own values, and communicate that with their partner early on in a relationship, preferably, so they kind of navigate their own destiny with where their relationship goes.
Has the interest in these kinds of discussions and fostering them increased in this, era of Me Too and, really changed notions of at some level, what relationships should be?
Right. I definitely think so, especially since we teach in schools. Schools are very regulated to make sure what they're teaching meets certain standards, science, math, English. But so a lot of times these softer skills aren't able to be taught in schools. But because of the harassment issues that not only happen in schools, but at home and at work, or assault issues, the schools are definitely now calling saying we'd really like to have this program. And they also even ask for it to be younger ages because we target middle school for this group. But some schools are like, I really think it should be younger. So schools are asking for it, and they see the value of getting to kids with this information before they develop those relationships.
Lauren, let me ask this, because I think it part of what I wanted to take this conversation to is some of it also just about changing the models? I mean, in terms, we've got Lord knows how many years of movies and all of that depicting relationships, particularly sexual relationships, as products of seduction, something you talk someone into.
Sure.
You, even in the best, let's assume there's no coercion, but you try to overcome resistance of some kind, whether it's just verbal or, I'm thinking even of the kind of fire that's being directed now at the Christmas holiday song, Baby, It's Cold Outside, which is, borderline, probably beyond borderline suggestive. Is that changing the way that we have to have these kinds of conversations with young people?
I think it is, and I think it's changing the way that journalists have to cover these conversations as well. It really has gone from, like you said, sort of seduction or the idea that maybe in a stereotypical instance, a man is talking a woman into sex, that it has to be a conversation. That's all consent is going over and over, people feeling comfortable with what they're doing and feeling comfortable with their bodies. And I think that it's really pretty clear that conversation, usually the onus has fallen on women, for women to say when they're feeling uncomfortable and when they don't want something to occur. And in society, women, and I'm sure our folks at the Kinsey Institute can speak to this as well, don't always do that. They don't always speak up for themselves. And I think Me Too has really put forward this idea that either through social media or just having the courage to speak up, women are able to share their experiences and talk about what they're going through and what they want to go through.
And I would love to be able to drag Zoe into the conversation right now, but we're having a problem with the phone line. With this weather, it's entirely possible that a line collapsed under the ice or something that. So we've just lost her right now. But I would say to others, if you want to join the conversation, you call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Tony, you talk a little bit about, what's going on with the school with this new sort of understanding that these relationships are not something, not only that should not be coercive, they probably even shouldn't be persuasive.
Right, right. Yeah, the old days where it was all about the pursuit and, but I did want to add on to Lauren's comments, too, about the Me Too movement. One thing we have seen in schools that is kind of an unintended consequence of the Me Too movement is male students not thinking that the consent applies to them. Unfortunately, 1 in 10 males are sexually assaulted too, mm-hmm. in Indiana and nationwide. So we've had a lot of them say, I thought I was, molested or raped, but maybe not, because Me Too looks like it's about the women. So I just mm-hmm. wanted to balance that out, that we definitely are talking about,
So it's important to tell guys it's okay for them to say no too.
Right, right. Yeah. And to speak up. If it was a rape situation or, reporting is usually low, obviously for men more than women. So there's those issues, too. But I think, in schools, what the kids ask us a lot is, so at what age can I consent? they always want to know their limits. So in Indiana, age 16 is the legal age of consent. If a child is 13 or under, and there's any indication that there's sexual activity, that would have to be reported, to DCS or Child Protective Services. So one thing we try to help the kids understand is the legal component of consent. But the other issue is that social, emotional, and trying to change the mindset of, one's pushing or pursuing the other. It's not about the win. It's not about the competition. It's about building a relationship And one thing about consent that I think is really important, especially for teenage relationships, is that it can change at any time. So I think, you know, in the old days, there was first base, second base, third base. But what we really teach is that someone might consent one day and be all for something. They may change their mind in the middle of that or after that, and that's still consent. And that's hard for kids to understand. You know, once you get the green light, as we say, it doesn't mean
it's perpetually green.
Yeah, that's a big, hard thing for people to understand, because I think, well, we had the conversation, we both agreed, you know, it's prom night, we're going to do it, but it's okay. People can change their mind at any time, and then it becomes no longer consent. So consent isn't just, you know, a yes or no. It's a very ambiguous thing, which is tricky and what gets people in trouble, but why it's important for them to understand that you're constantly looking for cues. If all of a sudden someone acts uncomfortable or, you know, they change, that's now becoming not consent, which we've heard, you know, in the news stories where that's caused problems for people.
Something that was interesting about this class, I mean, folks talk about, you know, our the generation that's probably in middle school now is maybe the YouTube generation. They want to be YouTubers when they grow up. And one of the ways that the instructor engaged the class was showing this viral video people might have seen go around Facebook, and it was about how consent is like tea, and the fact that, you know, you can make a cup of tea for someone and serve it to them and they don't have to drink it. If someone asks you to make them tea and you do and then says that they don't want to drink it, you can't yell at them, you can't hold them down and force the tea down their throat. And the kids sort of laughed at that, but then you could also see their wheels spinning and turning and realizing,
and making the,
wait a minute, there's a connection there. So I think that there's ways to explain it to young people that they understand and that the conversation can't happen, you know, at any age too young.
And I understand we have been joined now by Zoe Patterson again. Zoe?
Yes, glad to be here.
It's good to have you. I think that I'm not surprised on a day like today that the phone lines are a little bit problematic.
Yes.
So we've been talking, if you haven't been able to listen, about how teaching about and our understandings of what consent means have changed, particularly in the light of the Me Too movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think I think, you know, for many of us who have done research on sexual assault and sexual consent for many years, I mean, I think experiences haven't really changed. So it's not that, you know, there's lots more sexual assault or sexual harassment than there ever was. But I think the really positive thing is that people's awareness about the problem has changed. So the problem isn't new, but the awareness is, and that's, I think, really positive. And I think sets the stage for a lot of these, you know, really great interventions like the one Tanya's doing.
Well, let me ask this, Zoe, in terms of you know, the ways that we teach about it, though, has that changed? Because it is now, you know, we were talking about the fact that we've got, you know, more than a century of movies suggesting that relationships, particularly sexual relationships, can be the product of persuasion, seduction of some kind, rather than, you know, a mutually agreed upon activity. You know, how do we go about undoing those kinds of cultural messages that have been going on for decades, perhaps centuries?
So I think you're really right. I mean, I think, you know, for a long time, either consent has been portrayed as someone is reluctant and they get talked into it, or in the media, it's just not portrayed at all. There's no conversation whatsoever. Two people just, you know, fall into bed together and it's passionate and wonderful. And if anything, talking about it would ruin that passion. And so I think, you know, I think we've set up this idea that talking about consent or even talking about sex and what you want and don't want is somehow not sexy. And so I think, you know, part of what we can do is talk about sexual communication as part of having good sex, part of promoting better sex. So it's not, you know, you're probably not going to have the best experience, whatever kind of experience you want to have, if you just, you know, fall into bed and never discuss what you want. So I heard parts of what was being said before, and I really like what Tanya was saying before about talking, you know, kind of throughout the relationship about what are your values and what do you want and not want, and it really being much more than no means no or yes means yes, but a much more ongoing conversation.
We are talking about consent, sex education, really our changing understandings of sexual relationships, particularly among young people, on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You also can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Tonya Egan, she is with Life Smart Youth, Zoe Patterson, who's with the Kinsey Institute, and reporter Lauren Bavis. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues that we're doing in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media, we're continuing our community conversation about important public health issues. Today we're talking about sex education and really the meaning, the definitions of consent. My guests are Tonya Egan with Life Smart Youth, Zoe Patterson with the Kinsey Institute, and reporter Lauren Bavis. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Tom has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. My question was for the panelists on their thoughts about situations where females express that they don't want to do an expressed verbal consent at each step of the process and say the male should be able to just know or tell. And I understand that we should be able to look for signs, but also as a male, like, observing the nonverbal cues can be just as, can be a very difficult process for us. I just want to know how males should navigate situations like that.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Tom. I'll throw that one to Zoe first.
Yes. So I think often people do communicate consent in ways that are not verbal. Really, we communicate a lot of things in ways that are not verbal. So this isn't really specific to consent, but it may be even more common when it comes to sexual consent because people aren't very comfortable talking about sex and they haven't really been taught to talk about sex. So talking explicitly about what you want and don't want can sometimes be hard. But what I would say about that is I would say that if you aren't sure what the nonverbal signals are, that it might be really important to check in. So it's true. We don't always know what other people are communicating. And sometimes that's true even with verbal communication. We're not always interpreting what they're saying in the way that they mean it. And so I think that's why it's important to notice if someone seems hesitant or unsure and just to check in. And I think that's the easy solution.
Tonya, how much of this is also about people having to take responsibility for their own decisions and actively say, I'm owning this?
Exactly, which is what we're trying to help all youth understand. We define consent as a clear, enthusiastic, voluntary, and sober yes. So mm-hmm. if there's any alcohol involved, any substances, any doubt, we're saying if there's any doubt, then assume no consent. You know, you always want to err on the side of caution. But we really, it's a big issue. Like she said, that talking about sexuality, talking about relationships, these are teens, you know, learning, navigating relationships, and they don't really even know themselves sometimes. Well, how far do I want to go? But we explain to them that they absolutely need to have these conversations. Even if the conversation is just, I'm not comfortable even, if you're not comfortable even talking about it, then probably you're not ready to be doing anything. You don't have that inner awareness yet about your values and your boundaries. And so, you know, just kind of stop things where they are. But it is, I think this, what he raises is a key issue for a lot of people, that guessing game. And we have to get away from that. Obviously, it didn't work well. I mean, we've heard with a lot of people in the news, some of them were truly shocked. I mean, genuinely, that not realizing what they were doing was harassment. And I think we hear that a lot from people, that certainly wasn't everyone's intention, yet that is what happened.
How, you know, how much of this, and I'm thinking back, in terms of structuring these conversations, I want to hear everybody's thoughts on this, but I'll start with Tonya. I'm thinking about a conversation I had with a male college student some years ago. So, you know, none of my current students need to be sweating what's going to be revealed here right now. But this guy was afraid that he'd gotten a girl pregnant. And, you know, I talked with him and said, well, you know, didn't you take didn't you wear a condom? Didn't you take responsibility for the birth control? And his response was, well, you know, the condoms were across the room in my desk and I didn't want to get up and ruin the moment. And I thought, okay, if you think she's likely to change her mind in the amount of time it takes you to walk across the room, you probably shouldn't be doing this. But you hear that kind of thinking, that, and it's not just men, it's also women. They want to be swept up in the moment. That in some ways is the definition of romance. And, you know, think about consequences later or think about any of that. At some level, we all want to be swept off our feet. I'll start with Tonya, but how do you have those kinds of conversations with young people who are scared and insecure about sex to begin with?
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of what we believe is, I mean, that getting caught up in the moment for anything is what we're trying to help kids avoid, just by the prevention education. But we do a lot of role playing with the kids, not, of course, how to have sex, mm-hmm. but how to have peer refusal skills, how to get out of an awkward situation. And some of the kids, you know, might be like, oh, this doesn't apply to me. But once they role play it and they become comfortable with the situation, then when they're really in that situation, it's kind of a deja vu moment, like, oh, wait, I know, you know, my instincts are telling me this, but I was taught this. So we're very intentional about anticipating they're going to be asked to get in the car with someone who's a drunk driver. They're going to be, you know, at a party when other people are doing things. And how do they navigate out of those relationships without losing face or losing mm-hmm. friends? So the more we have these conversations and practice these skills and tools, we can hopefully prevent those caught up in the moment, caught by surprise, you know, actions.
Lauren, what has your reporting revealed about the nature of having these kinds of difficult conversations?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned it was a student of yours in college. I think what I hear from a lot of folks in Indiana is that these conversations belong at home. And what I found in my reporting...
Yeah, you're anticipating a line of questioning down that's coming, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, that's part of my job. what's interesting, there was new research that came out in the journal Sex Education that I quoted in this article that I wrote about the CARE program and consent. They took a sample of 18 states. These were urban and rural states from across the country. And they found that in health education materials, only 2 explicitly mentioned consent. And that's interesting. Indiana wasn't one of the states that was evaluated, but Indiana education, health education materials don't include anything on consent. And in fact, a new law this year has it that parents can review any sex education materials passed out in classrooms, and they need to opt their children into receiving that education. So this was in college. You were talking to a student. What the researchers who I talked to, who were part of the research published in Sex Education, said is these conversations don't happen at home. They don't happen in high school or elementary school or middle school. But what's scary is that 2015 data shows shows that 1 in 10 Indiana high school students has been physically forced to have sex. So before these kids get to college, this is happening to them. And by the time they get to college, it might be too late. So that's part of the big issue, is that these conversations might not be happening as early as they could, as soon as they could. And that can have really dire consequences.
Zoe, is that what your research shows? And could you also talk about, if it does, what are some of the costs and consequences of of us really having these kinds of conversations only in a slapdash fashion?
Yes. So, yes, there's lots of research that, high school students, junior high and high school students, are not getting this information anywhere, really, at school or at home. And most of the research on sexual consent, sexual assault, and sexual assault prevention is really happening at the college level. And, as people have said, most college students come in having had some kind of sexual history, some kind of sexual activity before they get to college. So we're teaching about consent, we're teaching about sexual assault to people who have already, been initiated into sex. And for many of them, they've already experienced sexual assault. A few of them have already perpetrated sexual assault. So I do think, it's really probably too late, but often we aren't given the opportunity to intervene earlier, which is when we should be intervening. And so students, come into college, I think, having not, given a lot of thought to what they do and don't want sexually, what their sexual values are, how to talk to their partner about those sexual values. So I really think there's a really great need to intervene a lot earlier and before people have started sexual relationships and sexual activity.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about sex education trends in Indiana and definitions of consent, how they may be evolving or at least being more deeply understood here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Grant has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Grant, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, John.
Hello.
I wondered what the opinion is on what prosecutors in Indiana do where you have two people and they're both intoxicated to the point where they can't give consent. They engage in sexual activity. And then the next day, one of them says, hey, wait a minute, I didn't really give consent there. What do prosecutors do? That's my question.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Grant. Zoe, I'll start with you on that one.
Yes. So I think, to be completely frank, I think alcohol makes this whole situation really complicated. So we generally teach that, if people are too intoxicated, then they're not able to give consent. But from a legal standpoint, there's not a lot of guidance about what is too intoxicated to consent. And frankly, there's just not a lot of writing about what should be too intoxicated to consent. And so I actually think that this is sort of a bigger problem. We know, especially among college students, but I suspect among high school students, although it hasn't been studied as much, that sex and alcohol are really paired in people's minds, that they intentionally combine those two things. And so that sets up, I think, a potentially dangerous situation. So I guess what I think is that we just need more intervention about, how to combine alcohol and sex and maybe about, not being careful about having sex with someone when either one of you has been consuming alcohol. I don't think it's realistic to say that people can never drink and have sex, but I think being really careful, if it's more than a drink or two. But in terms of what prosecutors should do and what the legal line should be, I don't know really, and I'm not a legal expert, but I think it is difficult and complex.
Lauren, does that actually complicate the question too? And when we're talking about dealing with sex education in the schools, as you pointed out now, it's a little bit of a minefield for educators to negotiate, at least in high school settings, if you're going to add into that discussion alcohol, which is the other thing that parents really love to have their kids talking about, you know, does that add to the complexity?
Yeah, so there's actually a column published in the New York Times that had to do with some research out of Indiana University. They surveyed more than 7,000 undergraduate students, and they found that consensual sex is less enjoyable and less strongly wanted when one or both participants has been drinking. They actually looked into this. And I think that there's definitely, from what this research shows, students of that age think that they need to drink in order to either have a good time or for their partners to consent. And that is not necessarily what the research shows.
Antonia, what do you, you know, in terms of this difficult combination of sex and alcohol, what do you tell young people about that?
Well, of course, I mean, we're always discouraging, you know, the alcohol consumption, talking about the effects that it can have on their decision making and making healthy choices, et cetera. But the bottom line is, you know, sex without consent is assault. So a person has to decide, are they comfortable with taking that risk? You know, you're intoxicated, the other person's intoxicated. You have to realize if indeed this is deemed as a non-consensual at some point, it's going to be considered assault. So it's a big risk, and all the more reason to have these conversations, you know, before the drinking begins, if it's going to begin. But we really encourage the kids, obviously, to figure out these boundaries and healthier choices, et cetera, and the impact it can have on their long-term lives, whether it's college scholarships, whether it's, you know, prison time and criminal justice system. I mean, there are serious consequences to not doing this correctly and understanding consent.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Patrice. If you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Patrice writes, I hope that your guests talk about why Indiana does not have open, frank sex education in schools. Sex has results of babies and diseases, yet young women and men continue to have false ideas of how to control these aspects. Frank, open discussion is needed. 50 years ago, when my California sex education opened the door for me to ask questions of my mother. Thank you for addressing a very important conversation. So let's talk about the politics of this, Lauren. I'm assuming you've covered that. You know, what is it that makes sex education so difficult for us to talk about in schools?
Legally speaking, it's just the different hoops that teachers have to jump through, that schools and teachers have to jump through. I mentioned earlier, so there's a brand new law in Indiana that parents have to opt in to sexual education materials, and they call it opt-in because schools are actually providing them, the parents, with consent forms that they're consenting for their children to learn about issues, sex education. Not necessarily consent, as some research shows. But yeah, these conversations, if they're not happening at home, they could be happening at schools. But it shows that they're not. New research showed that in a sample of 18 states, only 2 explicitly mentioned consent in their education materials. But what's interesting that the researchers found is that there's plenty of space in health education for conversations that have to do with consent. In health education across the country, these researchers found that the same themes of communication and decision-making and relationships were popping up. And you can talk about consent in any one of those conversations, talking about how, you know, relationships should be unconditional, but at the same time, you can have conditions in them that have to do with consent. I mentioned the unconditional relationships. That was something that actually came from the CARE class. They talked about how, yeah, relationships, your partner shouldn't be forcing you into, you know, looking a certain way or dressing or acting a certain way. But if they put a condition on you that says, if we're going to have sex, we need to use birth control, that is something that's more healthy and
that's reasonable. Yes, that is a reasonable condition. We are talking about sex education trends in Indiana and informed consent today on No Limits. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues that we do in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Tonya Egan with LifeSmart Youth, Zoe Patterson with the Kinsey Institute, and reporter Lauren Bavis. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about consent and sex education trends in Indiana. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues that we do with our partners at Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Tonya Egan with Life Smart Youth, Zoe Patterson with the Kinsey Institute, and reporter Lauren Bavis. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Martha has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's on your
Beautiful.
Mind?
So my name's Martha, M-A-R-T-A, and I'm a sex and kink educator based out of Indianapolis. And I just wanted to mention a few books that have been really wonderful and kind of paradigm shifting that address consent. One of them is a children's book that came out last year that's called Tell Me About Sex, Grandma. And it's by an author named Anastasia Higginbotham. And she's written a few other books that tackle hard topics, divorce, death. But this one is sold at Indy Reads Books in Indianapolis. And I'm 32 years old, and I cried. I cried reading it. Like, this is a book that has simple concepts that warrant revisiting even by adults. And the other book is called Ask, Building Consent Culture, and it's an anthology of essays that's edited by Kitty Stryker. And it's also, you know, you can pop in and read one essay and set it back down, and they're all just really thoughtful. So just wanted to suggest them for listeners and then see whether either of your guests have heard of them.
Thanks very much for the call and the suggestions, Marta. Tonya, I see you nodding your head up and down.
Well, I mean, those sound like excellent resources. I'm the CEO, so I'm not one of our health educators, but they often are looking for books for those younger kids, especially like you were just talking about, how to start having those consent conversations early on, and sensitive conversations about sexuality, medically accurate information about body parts, et cetera, which parents sometimes may not even know. So we wholeheartedly encourage reading and learning these things, whether it's from a research perspective, a story time perspective, and definitely buying those kinds of books that will help expose children to broader ways of thinking.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Tracy. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Tracy writes, "One day my 3-year-old niece refused a hug from my dad. She was just having a rare grumpy moment, so he tried again. My mom intervened and told him that she had the right to say no to being touched. While his behavior was benign, it was so important to say, even at her young age, teaching my niece that she has the power to say no is a valuable lesson. I, too, have been refused a hug on a rare occasion. Instead of having my feelings hurt, I celebrate her taking control of her body." I'm going to throw that one first to Tonya. I'd also like to hear Zoe's thoughts on that, because Tonya was actually mentioning this when we were on the break.
With the holidays coming up, it's kind of a good time to talk about this with, I mean, your 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds. You know, traditionally, I know when I grew up, you were kind of forced to hug or kiss that relative that you barely knew their name or who they were. And you internally, you kind of tensed up and hesitated, but your parents were saying, do it. Now we're saying, don't do that to kids. So consent, you know, it goes beyond obviously sexuality. It's allowing people to borrow your toys or your items. It's allowing someone to call you a certain name or nickname. You know, sometimes family members like to be cute and come up with nicknames. Well, it could be a hurtful nickname. And so having that conversation that that's not okay. And like you said, teaching the kid, even siblings, you know, the brother grabs the sister when they're, you know, just teaching siblings it's not okay to just grab and touch someone if they are not telling you that that's okay.
Zoe.
Yes, yes, I fully agree with everything Tonya said. I think it really is important to let kids be in charge of their own bodies. I think it's a really important message. And so, yes, refusing hugs can sometimes be awkward, but I think really allowing kids the freedom to do that and to experiment with what happens when I say no and do people listen to me, they learn a lot from that. So I think it really is important to listen to them and also encourage them to get permission before they touch other people. So, you know, we teach our son to ask before he gives people hugs. And sometimes someone says no, and it hurts his feelings, and that's hard as a parent. But I think helping your kids, you know, cope with the fact that, you know, they can manage rejection, and that other people will manage their rejection if they say no, are all really important messages.
So I'm going to play a bit of a devil's advocate here, and toss out, because I'm thinking, we're talking about how we've got to have these very, and we've got to prepare young people to have these tremendously difficult and intimate conversations about sex. It's been a long time since I was a teenager, but I remember, what I remember of that period was already having massive anxiety and insecurity about the experience. And to be told that, oh, gosh, if I read a signal wrong or something like that, I could be doing someone active harm, would not have dissipated that anxiety or insecurity in any way. It probably would have enhanced it. How do we go about actually saying to these folks, no, you know, with the right person and in the right circumstances, this can be a quite pleasurable activity? I'm going to start with Tonya on that one, and then I'll hear Lauren's thoughts and Zoe's.
Well, that's definitely a tough one, because you're right, because you also have sexting, you know, is a big issue. Mm-hmm. So you have to add, it's not the face-to-face always, you know, consent issues. There's a lot of this internet world that didn't exist when we were teenagers, thank goodness. So that it really is, I mean, we really encourage kids to seek healthy relationships where they have boundaries, they feel, you know, happy and content, and they're looking for those signs of whether it's, you know, different pressure or a potential abuse, et cetera. But I do think, you know, statistics show just in the past few years, high school students have decreased by 10% being sexually active in Indiana. So maybe that's part of it. You know, maybe there are some, there's more awareness of the complexity, not just because it used to be only about getting getting pregnant or getting an STD. Now there's this whole new layer to think about. So, you know, actual intercourse and sexual activity are actually declining. It's under 50% now for the first time in over 30 years in Indiana for high school students who are self-reporting being sexually active.
Lauren.
John, I think the way that you describe it is terrifying, and I think that's the way that a lot of...
Well, I guess, admittedly, I am of a somewhat different generation than you, and I apologize for cutting you off, but I just remember, God, I was terrified just to pick up the phone and call and ask her to go to a movie with me, much less having a kind of conversation like this.
Sure. But I think from what I saw when I was in the classroom and reporting, the idea is, like with any other educational topic, to sort of both ease students into it and even trick them in a nice way into understanding what the conversation is. Something that really stood out to me was this activity the students did. The educator passed out these pictures of hats, and I thought, what is she going to do with those? And she told the students, okay, well, every one of you now has a couple of pieces of paper that have hats on them. Go around and ask other classmates, can I have your hat? And if you want, you can give them your piece of paper, or you don't have to. And you saw the kids run around, and some of them grabbing pieces of paper out of each other's hands. And then once the educator made them all calm down and sit down, and started to explain it and said, did you tell people that you could do this? Who ripped a hat out of someone's hands? You saw the kids' eyes light up and go, oh my gosh, That's what rape is. That's what it is. It's you're taking away someone's choice. You're forcing something on them. And I mean, it was a silly lesson. It was a goofy exercise. But if you're starting young and bringing those conversations up and not starting them, say, in college and saying, you know, sex is fun, but also it can ruin your life. That's, you know, what's going to be more traumatic, I think, for young people.
Zoe.
Yeah, so I think I maybe have a slightly different perspective as a researcher. I actually do think consent is actually pretty complicated, because unlike, you know, asking for a hat or offering a cup of tea, I know you'd mentioned that video earlier, and I really like the messages and all that, but I think what's different about sexual consent is it's about sex. And I think you're absolutely right that sex is anxiety provoking to teenagers, in part because of the messages and the mixed messages they've gotten about sex for their entire life. You know, it's like on TV, it's passionate, it's amazing, you never have to discuss it, and it's always great anyway, and yet it's bad and dangerous, and you can get hurt and you can get sick. And so there's these very mixed messages around sex, and so I think that's what makes sexual consent unique compared to other kinds of agreement or communication, is that it's about sex. And so I think this kind of comes back to the need for early and comprehensive sex education, as one of your listeners talked about, that, you know, if we can help people very early on, as Tonya and her people are doing, to think about, you know, what is sex? What do I want in terms of sex? How do I tell someone what I want in terms of sex? How do I tell someone what I don't want in terms of sex? If they can, you know, sort of have exposure to those ideas and have kind of gone through those thought processes before they start having sex, that they'll be hopefully less anxious and better able to kind of navigate some of those complexities of sexual consent.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about definitions of consent and sex education trends in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Adrian has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Adrian, you're on the air.
Hi. So I was struck by the earlier discussion about sex education in school. I have a son in high school, and I remember a form coming home, and I hadn't really thought before that, like, what is being taught? Because if, for instance, consent isn't regularly being taught as part of sex education, I'm curious what really is being taught, and can I really trust that information that's being taught? And then, sort of on a separate note, I very much appreciate all the discussion around consent. I'd love to point out that hearing that somebody finds you attractive, isn't, you know, I want to kiss you or whatever, I feel like that could actually be really affirming for the person on the receiving end. So maybe we can look at consent also from that perspective.
Thanks very much for the call and for raising that point, Adrian. Zoe, I'm going to throw that one to you first.
I'm sorry, I think I missed the end of her question. What was the last
question? Oh, she said that actually that having someone say, I find you attractive, I would like to kiss you, actually could be affirming. That it could, you know, it could be something that that people would find pleasant.
Yes. So I think that's a great point. Okay, so there's sort of two parts to the question. What is being taught in schools? And I think the answer is it varies quite widely, and Tonya might have even better information than me, but it varies quite widely. In many schools, what is taught is abstinence, to avoid sex and some of the dangers of sex. But other schools have different programs. So it really varies kind of district to district, state to state. But as I think Lauren noted earlier, often consent is not included. And I think someone had asked, you know, like, why isn't there more kind of sex education and more consent education in schools? And I think in part, teaching consent might be politically controversial because it could be perceived as teaching people how to say yes to sex. And many people don't want teenagers to be saying yes to sex. So I think that's maybe part of the barrier, although there's certainly absolutely no research evidence that teaching consent causes people to have sex at all. There's no research that shows that, but I think that's sort of the fear. And then, yes, I think that's a really good point, that there might be ways to teach consent that fit better with how people expect to interact around sex. So if we expect people to say, do you want to have sexual intercourse now, yes or no? That feels a little awkward and probably isn't how people usually communicate around sex. But I think if we can help people find ways like saying, wow, I'm really attracted to you, I'd love to kiss you right now. Like that's a like, you know, affirming, flattering, and you know, sexy way to ask for consent. And so I think in part we need to give people more skills about different ways to ask for consent and to say yes and to say no, so that it doesn't feel like, you know, they're whipping out a contract and asking for a signature of consent.
Yeah, bringing witnesses in and notaries and all of that. We are talking about sex education here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, I'm going to try to squeeze one more call in. You can call us at 866-476-3881. As a listener named Charles has done. Charles, you're on the air.
Yeah, that my question might have been just touched on, but this business of consent, and then your panelists mentioned that it could have legal ramifications if you don't handle this properly. I just, the last person mentioned that it implied that it's oral. But should it be documented? Should it be written? Should it be recorded? I mean, if we're talking legal and it's a yes-no kind of thing and there's passion and all involved, if they could speak to that, I think it's implied that it's oral, but that's also a slippery slope. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks very much for the call, Charles. Tonya, yeah. I'll throw that one to you.
Well, technically, you're right. And from a legal perspective, if it's not in writing, it means nothing usually. But I think this is more from a practicality perspective that, you know, we all know, I guess, that given the circumstances and how relationships work, it's mostly going to be either via a text or oral with kids. So texting, obviously, would be getting it in writing. And with a lot of our youth today, that is how they communicate in relationships, whether they're breaking up or whether they're talking about heavy-duty topics like this one. So technically, those texts, I guess, could be written consent. And if someone wanted to kind of make sure they had that documented, that would probably be the best way to do it. But practicality-wise, you know, that may not happen all the time.
Lauren, it's probably
just to maybe
go ahead, and we're getting tight on time, Zoe.
Just to add to that very quickly, though, I also think that sometimes I've heard that students are using texts as sort of written documentation of consent. But I think the important thing is also that people can withdraw consent. So even if you had consent at one moment, doesn't
yes.
you necessarily do.
Exactly.
And I think someone ought to point out, I'll throw it to Lauren to get the last word here, that accusations, unfounded accusations of sexual assault are pretty rare.
They are, yeah. And there's not a ton, I don't think, of research that shows exactly what those rates are. And I think people want to point, you know, a specific number of what false reports are. But everything shows that that's not what happens very often. You know, believing people is what's important.
I feel like we just got this discussion started, so you're all going to have to come back sometime and we can finish it up since we are out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Tonya Egan, Zoe Patterson, and Lauren Bavis for a very, very lively conversation today. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.